From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, an early celebration of Mother's Day with an alternative look at the female life cycle. We'll hear from psychologist Joan Borisenko. Also, Lois Gibbs, a mother with a mission. She'll talk about Love Canal 20 years later. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. UN Chief Kofi Annan faced a hostile session today with Rwanda's leaders, outraged at the United Nations' refusal to take responsibility for abandoning their nation to genocide in 1994. Despite warnings, a slaughter was coming. Speaking before the Rwandan parliament yesterday, Annan acknowledged the world should have done more, but said that ultimately it was up to Rwandans to restore peace. The United Nations had expected a tough time from the Tutsi-led administration that now governs Rwanda, but the depth of the anger seemed surprising to Annan and other UN officials. With Annan looking on, the foreign minister blasted the UN chief before a chamber full of applauding lawmakers. Later, President Pasteur Bizimungu and other top leaders boycotted a reception for Annan after his own speech to Parliament. Presidential spokesperson Joseph Bideri said Annan's speech was arrogant, insensitive, and insulting to the Rwandese people. Bideri said Annan talked of the need for Rwandans to atone, yet he cannot atone for the failure of the UN in Rwanda, which led to the slaughter of Rwandans. Again, that a quote from the presidential spokesperson. Despite yesterday's snub, the president and vice president still would meet with Annan as scheduled today. The former political director of Teamsters Union, William Hamilton, pled not guilty yesterday to charges that include mail fraud and embezzlement related to the union's tainted 1996 election. Hamilton is charged with wire and mail fraud, embezzlement, conspiracy, lying to a grand jury, and lying to an election officer. He and others are accused of swapping contributions to political groups in exchange for contributions to incumbent union president Ron Carey. Carey's slim 1996 victory was overturned in November by a court-appointed monitor who found that Carey took part in a scheme to use some $885,000 in union funds for his campaign. Hamilton was released yesterday without bail on condition he surrender his passport. If convicted, he could get up to 30 years in prison. This news from Indonesia. Student protests against Indonesian dictator Suharto intensified nationwide today, with police firing tear gas and rubber bullets at students at one campus, injuring at least 15 and arresting 200 students at a protest in front of the parliament. Students who months ago chanted for economic and democratic reform are now increasingly strident in the face of Indonesia's continued economic troubles and repression, openly shouting contempt for Suharto, Asia's longest reigning dictator. Meanwhile, in Washington yesterday, P.S. Lustrilanang, an Indonesian student activist, testified at a congressional hearing. He was kidnapped at gunpoint at a bus stop in Jakarta in February, blindfolded, driven outside the city, and placed in a cell naked. Lustrilanang says Indonesian security forces tortured him in a variety of ways, including electric shock. Clinton administration representatives and Pentagon spokespeople did not show up at the hearing. Legislation was introduced this week to ban further training of Indonesian security forces. House Democrats said yesterday they will press for a showdown vote next week in an effort to oust Congressmember Dan Burton, the Republican of Indiana, as chair of the House investigation into the 1996 Clinton-Gore campaign's fundraising abuses. But Burton, under pressure after his release of selectively edited transcripts of former Associate Attorney General Webster Hubbell's prison conversations, said he intends to press on with his investigation of the flow of illegal foreign money into Democratic coffers. Some House Republicans have voiced their chagrin over Burton's latest predicament, coming in the wake of his labeling President Clinton a scumbag. And Speaker Newt Gingrich told a GOP conference meeting on Wednesday he was embarrassed for the chairman. President Clinton has decided against visiting Ireland ahead of a referendum May 22nd on a Northern Ireland peace accord. A spokesperson for the White House says the president is satisfied there is enormous public support to approve the deal. This news from Atmore, the state of Alabama, has carried out its first execution of the year. Stephen Allen Thompson was put to death in the electric chair early on Friday for the 1984 torture killing of a friend's fiancé. Thompson was 34 years old. And European governments, increasingly frustrated by the rising volume of American cigarettes smuggled into Europe, have decided to turn to Washington for help in investigating the involvement of American tobacco companies, starting with the R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company, this according to a senior European Union official. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. We now, on this pre-Mother's Day, at least the last time we'll be with you before Mother's Day, are going to turn to a psychologist who focuses on women. She is Joan Borisenko. She's author of a number of books, including Minding the Body, Mending the Mind. She trained as a medical scientist and a clinical psychologist. Her particular field of interest is psychoneuroimmunology, examining the psychological dimension to illness. Dr. Borisenko determined most medical studies were conducted on men's bodies because women's bodies are traditionally considered to be in a constant state of flux. Her latest book is called A Woman's Book of Life, The Biology, Psychology, and Spirituality of the Feminine Life Cycle. We now go to Dr. Joan Borisenko.
So I'd like to start telling you just a little bit of how I got interested in this whole topic. And that is that I'm originally trained as a medical scientist. And during the 5 years I spent doing a doctorate at Harvard Medical School, I heard almost nothing about the specific biology of women. We studied the 70-kilogram male, and it was just considered that a woman was a kind of 40-kilogram man with ovaries, and that's where it ended, and that there wasn't anything specific to study. And it went on from there, because I'm also a psychologist. I'm a clinical psychologist, and for a number of years, I did research in a field called psychoneuroimmunology, the effect of emotions on the body's immune system, and that's a tongue twister to say, actually. I have been now introduced 3 times as a psychic numerologist, which, unless you're in California, does not go over too well. It's like not enhancing to the credibility. But one of the things I did, of course, in that field was to review the whole literature on emotions and health, and then also to take a specific look at some of the literature on emotions and personality, because I was interested in the personality dimension of health and illness. And I found actually almost no studies that had to do with women. Practically every psychological study has been done on men, and that's because women are too complicated. We change every 7 days during the time that we menstruate. The emotions are different. The way that we think about things is different. The intuitive or wisdom aspect of the personality is different. And on top of that, we change with 7-year cycles throughout life. So it's very hard to control a study like that. So again, it was just assumed, oh, well, study the men, and you'll have the data that will apply to women as well. And it doesn't. What I've tried to do in this book is not to elevate women above the status of men or look for things that make us in any way superior, but to find out what is it specifically that motivates women, what are our own biological and psychological cycles, so that that can complement the male, both within us and within society. And so I started by actually looking at the Yellow Emperor's classic on internal medicine. This is an old treatise, over 1,000 years old, to see what it said about male and female development, if anything. And it turned out to be fascinating. It talked about the development of females in 7-year cycles. And it said, well, you hit the age of 7, the second teeth come in. You hit the age of 14, menstruation begins. At the age of 21, the body is fully mature and in full flower. At 28, the muscles are still developing. At 35, the whole structure begins to dry up, and at 42, with menopause, it's all over. That's it. So I thought to myself, that's rather unfortunate as a point of view, but things haven't changed a lot. We have basically the same view in medical science today. In terms of male development, what the ancient Chinese said is that men develop in an 8-year cycle. And they talked about men continuing to grow in wisdom into old age, whereas women, there was no wisdom at all that was recognized in women. It was just over by the time of menopause. And that's a very old view in Western society as well as in old Eastern society. If you go back as far as Aristotle, which I had a lot of fun doing, you can see what informed the Western worldview. Because Aristotle made a comment that woman is an unfinished man left standing on a lower scale of development. And, you know, it was interesting because they didn't know what determined gender back then. And actually they thought it had something to do with congealed menstrual blood that you kept in you, but it took the sperm to congeal the blood. And what Aristotle believed is that the vital molding force of the soul was present within the sperm, and that the congealed blood was just sort of raw material that got whipped into shape by the male vital force. And it was considered that if there was something defective in the sperm, he said if the sperm was cold and not vital enough, then you would get a woman born. You'd get a little girl because it didn't have enough pizzazz to create a boy. And that if not only was the sperm deficient, but the mother's menstrual blood was also deficient, then you would get the worst possible eventuality manifested, and that would be a girl resembling her mother. So this was, you know, we can laugh now, but the fact is that worldview has not so subtly permeated medicine and psychology in the West, and the way that various kinds of experiments have been run. About 7 or 8 years ago, a friend of mine went to see her gynecologist, and she wanted to know if a particular drug had any effect on estrogen and progesterone. And she had a great gynecologist who actually called up the drug company and asked the question. The drug company looked up the record, said, no, there's no effect. And she said, well, it's a common drug. Why don't you send me the research study? And it turned out that the research subjects were 600 men. So, you know, this is quite typical. And, of course, men do have estrogen and progesterone. You make it, too, but not to the same degree that that women do. So it seemed that something needed to be done. If you also look at the general fields of psychology and you look at psychological development, you have Erikson, you have Piaget, and they all studied boys as the benchmarks of development. And we know now that little boys and little girls develop very differently, that the benchmark for healthy psychological development in a young and adolescent boy is the development of independence and autonomy. And it was considered by many that little girls were defective, once again, because we don't develop independence and autonomy. Freud said, well, that's a failure to pull away from the mother because we don't have the Oedipus complex that boys have that makes us pull away because, you know, little boys supposedly are in conflict with their father for the attentions of the mother. So if they don't pull away, they're afraid of getting castrated. And this is what has informed psychological development. Since little girls bond with their mothers and don't pull away, we don't develop independence and autonomy. And it wasn't until very recent years, with the advent of the work of Carol Gilligan at Harvard and many women at the Stone Center for Women's Research at Wellesley, that a distinct psychology of the feminine life cycle, at least in its early stages, through adolescence, which is mostly what they have looked at, has started up. And what they have found at the Stone Center is that healthy women's development is not like that of men. That women develop not a sense of independence, but a sense of interdependence. That healthy development for women has to do with relationality. And that relationality is a concept of self, not alone, but self in relation to others. not the sense that we define ourselves by somebody else's view of us, but that when two people together are interacting, that interaction is greater than either one of them, that something larger arises from the parts, that a whole is larger than its sum. And I think that applies to our relationship in a certain sense, not only with others, but our relationship to the earth, our relationship to that source of being, whatever language you give it for, and that the innate spirituality of women has to do with interdependence, relationality, and keeping whole the web of life. And it's been interesting for me to see how that grows out of our biology. So I want to now talk about the four parts of the life cycle, and we'll take a look at their biology, psychology, and the way that that spirituality of interdependence and connectedness naturally grows out of it. First of all, if you look at the old women's literature, it talks about the feminine life cycle in three parts, maiden, mother, and crone. And it's actually time to update that. As late as the turn of this century, the average woman only lived until she was 47 years old. And, you know, in part, you can look at statistics and they can tell you a false story, because it wasn't that everybody dropped dead at 47. It was that most of us didn't make it through childhood. Infectious diseases were the thing. I live in a little town in the mountains of Colorado where the gold rush started. And you go up into the graveyard there, and what you see is the story of how life was 100 years ago, when you'll see grave markers for probably every child in the family at the same time. You'll see that a 2-year-old died, a 3-year-old, a 5-year-old, a 7-year-old, and that typhoid or diphtheria or whooping cough or something had come through the town at that time. So the second thing I noticed in the graveyard was that if you made it through childhood, as a woman, you were next likely to die in your mother years from complications of childbirth. But if you made it through that time, there were plenty of women who died in their elder years. There were a lot of women in that graveyard in their 80s and 90s. But nonetheless, the aggregate deaths were at 47. And sociologically, we were a very young country until recently. George Washington was 23 when he was a general, to give you an example. I have a 24-year-old son. It's hard to imagine him in quite that role. It's a lot of women, because this was a country that was really based on war and warfare. You know, we had waged war with the Native Americans. We waged war with the French. We waged war with the Spanish in the expansion. And it was mostly women, actually, who were left with the farms, who were left with the plantations. And it was teenage women, 17, 18, 19, who were the backbone of the country, things we don't think about. Anyhow, sociologically, we're now aging. And, of course, there's the baby boom that's crested in midlife, giving rise to a great, huge number of both men and women in the midlife years. But the fastest growing segment of the population is actually over 65. So we're a rapidly aging society. And we need to look at what that means to the women's life cycle. Of course, it affects the men's life cycle too, but this is not my topic, although I'm very glad that so many men have actually come here. It's delightful. So what I've done in looking and updating the maiden, mother, and crone is to say we need a fourth part of the life cycle. What's unnamed is midlife. And the name that I've given to the midlife woman is the guardian, for reasons that will become clear when we talk about the incredible nifty changes that occur physiologically, hormonally, and in our brains at midlife, which give rise to a kind of fierce woman and fierce wisdom that's very ready to say, the emperor has no clothes. The way that we are doing things is completely back-assed, and I'm not going to stand it anymore. And so that's why I call that stage of life the guardian. Back to the four cycles. I chose to look at 7-year cycles, not only because the Yellow Emperor looked at women's development in 7-year cycles, but because that's the sacred number of almost every culture on the earth.
And you're listening to psychologist Joan Borisenko. She's author of, among other books, A Woman's Book of Life, The Biology of Psychology and Spirituality of the Feminine Life Cycle. We'll be back with her on this pre-Mother's Day special in just a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with psychologist Joan Borisenko, author of A Woman's Book of Life, The Biology, Psychology, and Spirituality of the Feminine Life Cycle.
You look at Native American cultures, 7 and 4 are the sacred numbers. You have the four directions and the fact that the moon changes every 7 days, and the holy days, like in Lakota, always fall on the moon days. That's when the Sabbath is. It's a moving day. Every year falls on a different day of the week. And in all the way back as far as Pythagoras, rituals were always done in 7. The New and the Old Testaments are filled with references to 7. In the old women's literature, there is a wonderful story about the river Kleitor in Greece, which goes around the center of the earth 7 times, and it's a river of blood, and it comes out at the city of Kleitoris. And so that's quite an image and quite a symbol. But it was felt that whenever you moved from one stage of being to the next, whenever there was a ritual or initiation, you had to be dipped in the blood of that river, and that was what predated baptism. It was baptism in a river of blood and moon blood, menstrual blood, and that was the very first kind of calendar. So I thought to myself, well, this is true as a biologist. I know that those birthing rooms are filled on the full moon, and that 7 looked like a very good way to look at our physiology, both in terms of days within the month and years within the cycle. So within the first cycle, the maiden years, childhood and adolescence, I've looked in the Woman's Book of Life at the 3 cycles, 0 to 7, 7 to 14, 14 to 21. Then we have the mother years. And I'll just say parenthetically on the way that when I say mother years, I don't necessarily mean biological mothering. Only 80% of women mother biologically. And many women, for one reason or another, are either making the choice not to mother or having circumstances where they don't mother. So that number is growing. And I think that it's been difficult right up until now for people, for women who do not mother for whatever reason, who get stuck with the idea that somehow or other you cannot fully be a woman unless you mother. But we mother in many ways. I have several friends who have no children. And when we talk of mothering, one talks about having mothered her parents the whole time she grew up, of having mothered siblings, of mothering nephews, nieces, of mothering ideas, of mothering corporations, of mothering all kinds of things. And I think men can do that as well as women. Mothering is nurturing in its largest sense. So we'll return to those years, which are 21 through 42. The 3 cycles of the guardian years, or midlife years, are 42 through 63. And then the crone years, or the elder wisdom years, I would place at 63 to 84 and beyond. What research tells us is that right now the average woman's lifespan is about 79. And if you're in good health when you're 65, you'll live till you're 85 or beyond. So that the women's life cycle is definitely elongating. Now, let's take a look specifically at the maiden part of the cycle. There are some things here that are fascinating to me, and that is that from the very beginning, brain development in men and women is a little bit different. And I want to say right off that we're not two species, we're two genders, and we are much more alike than we are different. And that also, in terms of the nature and nurture controversy, if you grow up in different households, your brain development will reflect that. So, for example, whether you're male or female, if you grow up in an abusive home or an alcoholic home, you're going to have not only right brain dominance, but your right brain is going to be specialized for something very specific. It will be specialized to read the emotions on faces so you know when you're safe and when you're not. Women, however, even from very healthy homes, that's what their right brains are specialized from the very beginning. Whereas the male right brain tends to be specialized to see things in three dimension and for spatial orientation. It is emotionality and seeing precisely the nuances of what's going on with somebody that the female right brain is specialized for. And little girls are very good at this from a very early age. And they're very good at it all throughout their life, although they get out of touch with it and specifically begin to silence their relational wisdom somewhere around puberty. Carol Gilligan has written a great deal about this, which she calls losing our voice. And of course, Mary Piffer in her book Reviving Ophelia obviously hit a strong chord in society. What goes on to these incredibly bright relational little girls that they lose their voices and they lose their sense of self so often when the teenage years hit? And there's a lot of interesting research that has been done exactly on that. Carol Gilligan's group has been busy doing longitudinal studies of little girls and following them from early childhood through adolescence for a number of years. One thing I want to say about her studies is another comment I want to make about this book, and that is that many of those studies, for example, looking at the lives of adolescent girls at a place called the Emma Willard School in New York, she was looking essentially at white middle to upper class adolescent girls. And there's an author's note at the beginning of A Woman's Book of Life, which says basically, a woman's book of life, it takes chutzpah to even say you're writing this book. I know that it's the first sentence in A Woman's Book of Life. And I know that this work, too, applies mostly to essentially white women in well-to-do circumstances. The life cycle may be very different for women of color, for Hispanic women, for women who have recently migrated to this culture. It may be very different for lesbian women or for disabled women, and so I'm aware of that. But we have to start somewhere, so this is where we're starting, at least I'm starting. So as I take a look then at little girls, I want to tell you a couple of stories. What happens at about the time of menstruation? What happens to silence us? Carol Gilligan said that little girls would often tell her, around the fifth or sixth grade, that they had learned that telling the truth was foolish, that it got you into trouble, and that it was better not to tell the truth. And it's that time that women start to hide behind stock phrases like, oh my, isn't that interesting? And those don't serve us so well. The voice, some of us begin to get it back earlier, but some of us not until later. By puberty in most girls, there is a sense of silencing. Part of that, too, is sociological. And that is that for the little girl, everything is possible. For the adolescent, there's already a recognition that although there may be a lot of lip service given to feminine power and feminine rights in our culture, there still we're second-class citizens in many, many ways. And there's a kind of depression that sets in. So it was, I think, Simone de Beauvoir which said Freud was wrong when he talked about penis envy. What really goes on is power envy. And that, I think, is partly the case. I want to say a few words about puberty, because right at this time that all this stuff is happening psychologically, that the little girl is waking up to the fact that she's not living the life of Pippi Longstockings and other things are going on in the society, huge hormonal fluctuations are occurring within the body. And as part of that, in other cultures, there have been rituals that welcome women into motherhood, into the puberty years and into their incipient motherhood, to the ability to mother. In Iroquois culture, for example, a girl at puberty was revered for her dreams. Whatever dreams came at this time were felt to be intuitive and to contain the wisdom that the tribe really needed in order to continue, and in order to continue in what they would call a good way, the wisdom. So it came from the young women who would eventually become the elders of the tribe. And those tribes, by the way, did not go to war unless the women said that they should go to war, because it was believed that it was the women who held together the web of life and who could tell what was going to be best 7 generations into the future. So it was very different. All of women's wisdom was looked at in a different way. What goes on at the time of puberty has been very different in Western culture. Pliny the Elder, who was a first century Roman naturalist, said that a menstruating woman dulls the shine of mirrors, blunts the edge of ivory, and can kill men with a glance. Actually, that's a lot of power, isn't it? It's pretty good. But I'm Jewish by birth and tradition, and we have many laws of menstrual cleanliness called the laws of Nidah. If you take a look at what goes on in Christianity, up through the 14th century, women were not allowed in the great cathedrals of Europe because they might be menstruating at that time, unclean and therefore defiling holy ground. It's interesting to look at the differences in the cultures. In Native American culture, women aren't allowed to be in ceremonies either, but for a very different reason. It's felt that the power, the intuition, the insight, and the personal medicine of a woman is so great when she's menstruating that it is greater than what goes on during the ceremony. It's sort of like there's so much energy, psychic energy that comes in, it could be disruptive. So I can understand that the original power came to be feared in a certain way, but it was really always fear of a woman's power in some way that gave rise to these different kinds of points of view. There's some very interesting biological research, about what happens during puberty and what happens specifically during menstruation every month of the childbearing years. To make a long story short, right brain activity increases when a woman is menstruating. And there's something called the dichotic listening test, when different words are presented to different ears and they go therefore to the contralateral or opposite side of the brain. And the sort of take-home lesson of this particular set of experiments that was done is that, number one, women hear more negative words during their period, which is like we didn't need large studies to tell us that this was the case. Most of us have experienced it. But the authors of the study says, you know, it ends there. People say, well, PMS, bitchy women, really negative, you know, full of nasty stuff. But the fact is that this is due to the fact that there's increased right brain function, increased insight, increased creativity, a much enhanced dream life at this time, and great intuitions about how apparently unrelated things are in fact quite related. And if we looked at it in the right frame of reference and we said once a month, everything that is negative, everything that prevents the cycle and circle of life from cohering, anything that blocks the flow of energy in the web of life, comes up to be looked at, we would say, this is truly an incredible thing. And we wouldn't say, you know, oh, phooey, PMS has come again. Let's give everybody medicine. We could put them all on birth control pills to get rid of this. know, this has been part, in a certain sense, of the way that medicine has looked at all of the women's hormonal cycles. If they could just put us on hormones, the moment that we hit puberty and take us off to have a child once in a while, all the moods would be controlled, you see? But that's a very interesting mood, and it's that ability to cry foul during the time of the menses that has really been feared. And so I think we've lost sight of it and lost power because of it. Now, another thing about the adolescent years, here we are, we're coming into this great power and great insight and into a society that obviously is not about to honor much of it, and we lose our voice. At this same time, however, got all this relational energy going on, all of this compassion and empathy that's continuing to develop, and the frontal lobes of our brain are busily embroidering in what is socially acceptable. And at this time, what Carol Gilligan talks about is the main adolescent thing that has to be learned for a girl is a boundary issue. And that is, where do I end and where do other people begin? How can I be compassionate to others without, you know, without, if I'm compassionate to others, does that mean I have to ignore myself? And if I choose for myself, does this mean that I'm selfish? To me, it's amazing that she considers this an adolescent issue, that if we're healthy, we'll finish in adolescence. I'm still working on it, and most every woman I know is still working on it. I think it's like the major developmental struggle of an entire woman's life is this boundary issue. All right, a quick tour of the mother years. Things have changed a lot in the mother years since I grew up, certainly. I grew up in a fairly well-to-do suburb of Boston. My mother stayed at home, and I didn't know a single woman in her circle that worked. Nobody worked. Everybody was a homemaker. And in that particular circle, even the homemakers had maids. There wasn't a whole lot to do but to haul us all around to ballet lessons, basically. And I was groomed from the time I was a little girl actually to marry an ophthalmologist, or failing that, an orthodontist. This was what was expected of me. And my mother told me, whatever you do, don't let any boy know that you're smart, because if they know you're smart, they will feel threatened, and then you will not get married, and then you will have a miserable life. Mm-hmm. And so that was difficult. And I think many women of my generation were brought up like that, in the shadow of what Betty Friedan called the feminine mystique. And if you think about it, times have changed awfully rapidly. Now the majority of mothers work. This was unheard of. Just, you know, I'm 51, so 40 years ago it was unheard of, and it's changed hugely. And we haven't had a lot of role models to tell us how to do this. This generation, my generation, has really broken ground in that. There was a study done at Wellesley College called the Life Print Study, which told a lot about these mother years. One of the things that became clearest was that women in their 20s are the most stressed that they ever are in their whole life, because you're trying to figure out, what are you going to do with your life? You know, will I have a relationship? Will I have children? Do I want a career? What kind of career? You're setting out on a life structure. There's a fellow by the name of Daniel Levinson, who he actually died about a year ago. He was a psychologist at Yale. Several years ago, he wrote a book called The Seasons of a Man's Life. And it was on that, by the way, that Gail Sheehy based her book Passages. Once again, Passages was based on the male life cycle, not the female life cycle. Just last year, Levinson published a book. It was actually published posthumously. His wife completed it, called The Seasons of a Woman's Life. And he interviewed a lot of women in the mother years, and his data and the Life Prints data are most of what we know about these later times in the feminine life cycle. But what Levinson really was saying was that the entry-level life structure, in his words, is doomed to fail. You see, I don't see it that way. I feel like it's a first approximation. There are no failures.
Joan Borisenko is a psychologist who's written many books, including A Woman's Book of Life, The Biology, Psychology, and Spirituality of the Feminine Life Cycle. She gave her talk at the Bodhi Tree Bookstore in Los Angeles, California.
This is a special pre-Mother's Day edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, and we continue with our Mother's Day special, I guess pre-Mother's Day special. 1998 marks the 20th anniversary of the evacuation from Love Canal. Love Canal first hit the headlines in 1978 as an entire community in upstate New York struggled with the fact that it was living on top of a toxic waste dump. Within weeks, a grassroots movement forced national decision makers to pay heed, and the community was evacuated. Love Canal entered modern mythology as one of the most notorious environmental scandals in the world. Yet 20 years later, homes at Love Canal have been resold, and some 50,000 similar sites remain. Today, we're joined by a mother with a mission. That's right, Lois Gibbs. Some might call her the mother of the modern-day environmental movement. She's the executive director now of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. And we want to revisit Love Canal 20 years later, as the story does continue. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Lois.
Thank you, Amy.
So tell us about Love Canal 20 years later.
Well, 20 years later, 900 families have moved out, and new families are moving back in. Love Canal has become a piece of history that's about to repeat itself. There are still 20,000 tons of chemicals that were there in 1978 that awoke me to the problems of environmental threats and pollution and danger for our children and our health. And the 20,000 tons is still there, and one-third of Love Canal is being resettled, while two-thirds of Love Canal is being determined not habitable. And the way this works, which is just mind-boggling, is you could walk down the middle of this suburban road. It's a suburban working-class neighborhood. And on the right side, you see a mound of dirt that has a 10-foot green fence around it and boarded-up houses on the other side of this mound. This is the area that they declared uninhabitable. It looks like a ghost town. If you were to look on the other side of the street, you see these beautiful real estate-like brochure picturesque homes with flower block boxes in the windows, with children playing on bicycles. It is the most stunning thing to see because Love Canal is not safe. Those children who are playing on the northern end are going to be made sick, are going to be exposed, are presently being exposed, and there's 20,000 tons of chemicals still in the center of the neighborhood. This is history coming right back at us, repeating itself.
Lois Gibbs, you know, as so often happens with something that becomes a symbol, is that the original story, well, a lot of people don't know the details, and we also have a lot of young listeners who may not have ever heard of Love Canal. Can you describe what happened 20 years ago and how you came to find out that the neighborhood you lived in was contaminated?
Sure. 20 years ago, I was a homemaker. I was a mom of two children, and I bought the American dream, as you can imagine, or as I imagined it would be, a picket fence, a fully employed husband, healthy children, and moved into the Love Canal neighborhood, setting up housekeeping, going about my business. And one day, I picked up our local newspaper, and in our local newspaper, it described the Love Canal dump site, which was three blocks from my home, that was an old abandoned canal that the water was pumped out of, and 20,000 tons of chemicals were dumped into the canal. It was covered up with dirt, and a school was erected on the perimeter of the dump. From 1940s and 1950s, when they dumped the waste, until 1978, the waste moved out of Love Canal and into the neighboring community under the school that my child was attending kindergarten at. it was shocking to read this. My children were very sick, and for years I had tried to figure out why. Michael had asthma, epilepsy, urinary tract disorder, and my daughter had a very rare blood disease. It wasn't until I read this article that the light bulb sort of went off. It's like, this is the problem. There's 20,000 tons of chemicals 3 blocks from my home, by the elementary school, under the playground my children played with daily. And I was just stunned. What also stunned me is the way government reacted to it. When I found out about that, the first thing I wanted to do was to move my child out of that public school. And I went to the school board and I asked them if they would please move Michael, and they said no. And I was shocked. It's like, what do you mean no? There's 20,000 tons of chemicals. My son is incredibly ill, and I believe it's related. This is like a no-brainer. How can you say no to me? And what he said was, if we move Michael Gibbs, then we're going to have to move all 407 children who attend that school. And we're not about to do that for one irate, hysterical housewife who is looking to blame her problems on someone else. And that's when I got my first education about how government doesn't work. I mean, I literally had to knock on every single door in government and got exactly the same response. And it wasn't until our community organized itself. I went door to door with a petition, at first to close the school and later to evacuate the entire neighborhood. People came together, housewives, factory workers, and stood their ground and began to approach the politicians about, you have to do this. People are getting sick. This is the right thing to do. Industry is acting irresponsibly. And it took us 2 years to finally get the relocation of all 900 families in the community.
We're talking to Lois Gibbs, and she was the leader of the fight against environmental pollution and for the truth in Love Canal 20 years ago. And she's an environmental leader today, executive director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. She's also written a new book. It is Love Canal, The Story Continues. Now, you talked about they and the fact that this was dumped. Who was they?
A Hooker Chemical Corporation, which is a subsidiary of Occidental Petroleum, dumped the waste in the abandoned canal in the 40s and 50s. What is also interesting is that Occidental Petroleum just gave $250,000 to the city of Niagara Falls to fund the building of a park in the old abandoned Love Canal neighborhood. So even the company hasn't learned anything from this history. They're going to build yet another park there. They're moving people back in there. And, you know, we're going to hear from moms years from now, just like myself, who said, I believe government. I believe that they wouldn't let me move into this house if it wasn't safe. And now look where I am. Look at the health of my children. Look at the health of my loved ones.
You know, Democracy Now!, the Pacifica National program that you're on right now, often focuses on grassroots activists and also the strategies that people use. At that time, how did you go from being a mother who demanded that her kids be moved from the school to becoming a national figure and actually succeeding in getting the President of the United States involved with this environmental catastrophe in your neighborhood of Love Canal?
Well, on a personal level, it was very difficult. I was a very shy, quiet, non-involved person. But when your children are at stake and the health of your children are at stake, it's amazing what people can do. And I think I'm an example of that. Going door to door with a petition was something that I would have never believed before Love Canal I could ever do, let alone the rest of it. But some of the strategies that we learned at Love Canal we're actually using today. And they were strategies that we came up with on the seat of our pants. A bunch of us women sat around the table and said, okay, what are we going to do about this? We first approached the issue by looking at scientists and saying, if we could prove beyond the shadow of a doubt that 56% of our children are born birth defected and there's 20,000 tons of waste, which is a likely cause, surely the right thing would be done, meaning that people would be relocated. So we did a health study and we presented all this scientific data to the New York State Department of Health and to the EPA. And we said, look, this is what's going on. they came back at us not saying, we agree with you, but they said, yes, there is 56% birth defect rate in your neighborhood. We don't question your numbers. However, we don't believe that it's a result of the 20,000 tons of chemicals that were buried there. We believe that it's a result of a clustering of genetically defected families all living in the same neighborhood. And I was like, excuse me? How can you say that? We did a number of other sort of scientific proving things, and we realized very quickly that science is not the answer, that we cannot take on these huge issues and win them based on science because we can't compete with the amount of scientists and PhDs that the other side, meaning the government and the industry, can line up against us. Our next step was to look at the legal route. This is America. Everybody can sue everybody over anything. And so we decided that we would go the legal route and determine whether or not we had some kind of legal rights that we could force them to move us. What we found out is that in America, it is quite legal to poison people. In fact, they give permits to poison people. And so that we didn't have any legal standing in this case, which was also something that totally shocked me. It popped my American bubble dream. I just couldn't believe that was happening. The way we won Love Canal was political. We went after the elected officials, and we forced them to do the right thing because it was politically advantageous for them to do the right thing, not because of science, not because of any other reason. For example, Governor Hugh Carey was running for re-election in 1978, and as a result of his campaign going across the state, we followed him all across the state. We went to his $1,000 plate dinners, and we handed out flyers asking Governor Hugh Carey what he plans on doing about the suffering at Love Canal. When he was at a ribbon-cutting affair, we were there with our signs, with our folks. Wherever Governor Hugh Carey went, we were right there. He finally just basically said, I give up. I give up. What do you want? And he did his first evacuation order on August 2nd, 1978. And that's how we fought it. We literally went after the elected officials. We made them, we really talked to their voters. We made the voters call them up and show, you know, that they didn't care and that if they wanted to stay in office, they have to care about human health and the citizens that were in New York State. We did the same with President President Carter when he was running for re-election in 1980. We literally had people in California, in Florida, in Mississippi, all over the country carrying signs focused at President Carter. And as a result, in October of 1980, because of this activity, he agreed to evacuate all 900 families. But the evacuation should have happened without doing that. That's the sad part of it. People were sick. 56% of our children were born birth defected. Women were unable to carry children. Poison was seeping in our basement walls. But despite all of that, no one would move until it became politically advantageous for them to do so.
It's an absolutely incredible story. Again, Lois Gibbs is our guest today, and she has renewed a book she wrote earlier. It's the 20th anniversary revised edition of Love Canal, The Story Continues, and it certainly continues for Lois Marie Gibbs because she continues to fight for environmental justice in this country. Now, Lois, I met you a few years ago down in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, where I was covering this environmental racism conference that you were holding there, an environmental justice conference. It had about 500 people there. I was the only broadcast journalist there. This was Cancer Alley in Louisiana, and it seems that the corporate media does not want to, or perhaps because they're owned by some of the very corporations that do this polluting, recognize the power of and how large this grassroots environmental movement is becoming today. Can you talk a little about what you're doing now? I mean, at the beginning of this segment, I read that we're talking about some 50,000 similar sites in this country, similar to Love Canal. Is that possible?
It's absolutely possible. There are that many sites. And, you know, the media doesn't widely cover these issues. And it's unfortunate. And I think it's in part because the media is threatened by it. Who owns ABC? Who owns CBS and NBC? Those are the same companies that are out there polluting people. And so as a result, it is not in their best interest to cover stories such as what was happening in Louisiana. The other thing that they don't want to cover is the deliberate dumping on on people. There has been a number of documented studies that have shown that people of color in low-income communities and communities that are struggling to have low formal education base and high elderly population, high unemployment, are the very communities in which the same companies like Westinghouse is dumping on. And as a result of that, they don't want to talk about it. But this is environmental racism and an environmental justice issue that we cannot allow as a society to say because these people are politically weaker or don't have the resources to come back and struggle with this, that we have some kind of right to pollute them. And that's the bigger struggle that we're in now, how to stop industry and government's permission or alliance with industry to dump in the Cancer Alley communities, to dump in different places. I mean, you look at Rochester, New York today, there is a neighborhood with children with 39 brain and central nervous system cancers existing today. 39 in one neighborhood. What's going on there? Well, what's going on there, according to the community, is that Kodak has an incinerator that is polluting that neighborhood. Is it related to Kodak? I don't know. But nobody wants to check it. Nobody wants to cover that story. But here are a bunch of families trying to struggle through their day-to-day life, and it's just totally unfair.
And, of course, in California, you've got Silicon Valley, you've got Richmond and the Bay Area.
That's right. I mean, it's all over the place. And the other thing that I think is real important and why nobody else wants to talk about this is because of the cost. You know, to clean up Love Canal costs a lot of money. You talk about 50,000 other sites, that's going to cost a lot of money. And the industry doesn't want to pay it. And the industry is not going to support the candidacy of elected officials who are going to stand ground and say, we've got to clean this up. We've got to pay this. Right now across the country, the number one increasing cancer incident is in children. Why is that? I believe it's because of these 50,000 sites. It's because our food is laden with pesticides. It's because our cheese and our milk is full of dioxin. We need to do something to protect our children. 0 to 4 has a very high rate of cancer. Well, children 0 to 4 years of age have never worked in a dirty industry, has never smoked a cigarette. You know, what is causing these children's cancers? And I think it's related to this environmental issue. And it affects everybody. It's not just the moms and dads and people who live at Love Canal or who live in Richmond, California, or who live in Cancer Alley. It has now, because the corporations have been so careless and the government representatives have been so unresponsive, the Love Canal chemicals have now moved onto every single person's table, and it's time to get them off our table and get them out of our environment.
Well, Lois Gibbs, I want to thank you very much for spearheading this movement for so long. Lois Gibbs, Executive Director of the Center for Health, Environment, and Justice. I want to know how people can get in touch with your group, and also if people want to get a hold of the book, Love Canal, The Story Continues, they can go to bookstores or where can they call?
They can call 703-237-2249 for information and to order the book.
Again, that number?
703-237-2249.
And the book, Love Canal, The Story Continues, is published by New Society Publishers. Lois Gibbs, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, that does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of Democracy Now!, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hisu Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. Our engineer in Washington, Joe Gill. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Something to you.